It is good to see this number of people who are interested in the things of God, in a willingness to come together and spend a few moments in quiet reflection of those things that God would authorize of us to do. We might challenge our minds and challenge our lives to strive to be better people before God. As we study together tonight, I want to begin with something that I know is very familiar to all of us, because at one time or another in your life, you've engaged in that. Whatever the name it may have gone by when you were a kid, nonetheless, you one time or another played the game pretend. And basically all that is when you just simply pretended to be something that you were not. It might have been that some of the earliest recollections that you might have of that kind of a situation is when you pretended to do the kind of things that your mother and dad were engaged in. It might have been that if dad was a fellow who was out here on the tractor, that for a long time that you pretended that you could drive the tractor just exactly like he did. And then it didn't take very long until your world expanded a little bit, and the next thing you knew, you were engaged in all kinds of activities in which you were pretending to be whatever it was that you thought maybe you wanted to do with the rest of your life. Maybe you were pretending to be a policeman, or maybe you were pretending to be an astronaut, or maybe you were pretending to be a fireman or a professional sports athlete of some kind. Whatever it may have been, there was something that you were engaged in that was a part of that kind of makeup and make-believe kind of world. And you know, one of the things that has kind of helped the game pretend through the years is the fact that if you could dress up with whatever it was that you were pretending to be or be involved in, that always helped make the game much more real. And so today, for example, a kid who wants to pretend that he is a superstar on the professional football field, you can go out here and you can buy him a helmet, and you can get him shoulder pads, and you can get him a little uniform that will look like one of the colors that the pros wear, and you can get him a football and turn him loose out here, and he can pretend that he's a superstar, and he's making multi-million dollar contracts and doing all kinds of commercials because Bo knows, and there he is out there pretending just to be what he thinks he'd like to be. Or doctor's kits have been around a long time, and look how many kids have pretended that they were a doctor somewhere or another, and they've got those little stethoscopes around their necks, and they come up to mom and dad and they want to check your blood pressure and they want to take your temperature, and they got this little bottle that looks like it's full of pills, and they give you a prescription, and all of that just simply makes, as it were, whatever it is that they're pretending to be much more real or much more alive to them. And after I've said all of that, I say that so I can say this. Maybe you'll go out tonight and say, no, I think you're mistaken, that I actually played this game. But you know, one of the things I've noticed through the years about the game pretend is this. I've never met anybody that ever pretended to be God. That's a game that kids don't play. Children don't pretend to be God. It's not until we get a little bit older that sometimes we begin to think that maybe we can get by with such, and that just maybe somehow or another, or some way or another, we can actually pretend that we can be God. And that's really what I want to talk with you about tonight. I want to talk with you about the sin of man playing God, because I believe that there are some who are very guilty of this. In fact, by the time we got done tonight, it might be that as you look at your own life, you may see that you've been guilty yourself of the sin of playing God. I say that because, one, this is not a new game. Not where adults are concerned. This has been around a very long time. And all you have to do is to turn to the first chapter of the book of Romans and read just a few verses with me, and you'll see indeed that there have always been people who have wanted to get into the role of being God. In the 18th verse, Paul says, beginning, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them. For God has showed it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so they are without excuse. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and change the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like the corruptible man, and to birds, and four-footed beast, and creeping things. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, who changed the truth of God into a lie, and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. Notice, here were people who were pretending to be God. And basically what he says is that these were people who tried to change some things. They tried to change even the very basic of things, the very image of God himself. And he says, as a result of that, look what happened. They ended up worshiping that which was the creation of the hand of God rather than the worship of the Creator, God himself. And I think that as you look down through those verses that we've just read and could continue to read down through the end of the one chapter there, you would be able to see that here very clearly is a description of some people who want to try to play God. Another passage that comes rather readily to mind that points out the same kind of thing is over in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, and by our gathering together unto him, that ye be not soon shaken in mind, or be troubled, neither by spirit, nor by word, nor by letter, as from us, that the day of the Lord is at hand. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he, as God, sitteth in the temple of God, showeth himself that he is God. There certainly is a description of somebody who wanted to play God, isn't there? In verse 3, you're able to see that this one is identified as the man of sin. And this man is certainly guilty of trying to play God. Look at the description again that's given here in verse 4. He opposeth God, he exalteth himself above all that is called God, and is set forth as God, so that he is worshipped, as it were, as God. And I certainly would suggest you couldn't get a better description of the kind of problem that we're talking about tonight than what Paul says right there. And one of the things he's wanting these brethren at Thessalonica to understand is that this is going to be a reality, that this situation is going to arise in the apostasy of that first century church. And what that means is that whatever kind of situation that he's describing here is not something that they're going to necessarily find way out here in the world, though indeed there were illustrations of it out there in the world. But it would be such that would arise from among them. It would be such that would come from the spirit of those who were supposed to be serving and worshiping Christ and the Father. And so here you get a good description of that. And if I were to say to this group, who is this? Who is this man of sin that's described here in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 in verses 3 and 4? There would probably be a variety of answers in this audience, but I freely admit I think one of the most prominent ones that I would get would be the fact of what's almost inevitably said by anybody who ever comments on the passage, and that is, well, the Pope of Rome certainly fits this kind of a description. And I'd have to admit, and I think you would too, that insofar as fitting the description, that is exactly so in regard to him. I mean, after all, anybody who would identify himself or is willing to be identified by others and under the terms of universal father or universal bishop, certainly that kind of a person would have to fit under the description that's given there in verse 4. Not only that, but what about a fellow who would say that at times at least that he speaks infallibly for God? That when he speaks from the throne, as it were, he speaks from God. And that whatever is said there is bound just as much as if it was spoken from the mouth of the Apostle Paul or any of the others whose apostleship could not be questioned, even though it may have been challenged and even though it may have been examined and tried in the days of the first century, that here's one who says that I speak infallibly. I think indeed you'd have to say that here's a fellow who fits the kind of description of playing God that Paul gives here. But he's not the only one, is he? In fact, I would suggest that there would be a number of people in Protestant denominationalism that likewise would fit pretty readily in the kind of description that is given right here. I mean, after all, what about all of those religious title wearers? What about the folks who want to have themselves addressed by the title of distinction, Reverend? Even in spite of the fact that the 111th Psalm in verse 9 says that this is a term that only is designated in the Scripture in relationship to God, that holy and reverend is His name. And yet we use this as a title of distinction, a title of elevation, where we set one individual above others and we give unto him glory and honor that we just really aren't going to accord to the rest of us. I would suggest that a fellow that gets in that kind of a role or that kind of a position treads on the very same kind of ground that's described right here. He may not take it to the fullest extent that some others would, but he's on the road of doing that very same thing. Or what about the titles that might be used as rabbi or even the title father? Do you remember in Matthew chapter 23, verses 8 through 12, where Jesus speaks in regard to those particular issues? He indicates to not have anybody call you by the term rabbi, not have you spoken of in regard to the title father. Now, he's not speaking here in regard to physical relationships as a result of the blood, as it were, that flows in your veins. But rather, he speaks from the standpoint of those things that are religious in and of their nature. And he tries to get us to see that we have one Father from that kind of a consideration or standpoint, and that is God. And yet what happens? We've got a host of people who are out here differentiating themselves and separating themselves by such titles as that. And so if you look out in Protestant denominationalism, you'd sure be able to find some out there, likewise, that would meet the kind of description that's given here again. But do you know something? You don't even have to go that far. It seems to me that you don't have to go any farther than the Church of the Lord until you realize that even there we can be guilty of the sin of playing God. The New Testament writers seem to recognize that. Paul especially, and Peter likewise. Maybe we'll start with Peter in 1 Peter chapter 5 and in verse 2. Recognize that problem or the tendency that might develop among those who would serve as elders. One of the things that he talks about there is the fact that they are not to lord it over the flock. Now here you're able to see the same kind of descriptive figure that is used basically here in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, playing God. Because here's a fellow who is taking the leadership that God does not intend him to take, and he's taking it and extending it in a way that God has not authorized for a person to take. And when you stop and think about Acts chapter 20, you're able to see that here among those who were elders, the very first apostasy was going to arise, that there would be men who would speak perverse things and they would draw away disciples after them. Basically, what they were going to do was to set themselves up as God insofar as their authority was concerned, and they were going to be able to sway some others to kind of follow along with the way that they were thinking and the things that they were saying. And the next thing you know, you've got an organizational structure that is vastly different than the simple New Testament pattern that has been revealed in the pages of the New Testament. And basically what you're seeing there is somebody who lords it over the flock in order to get their way in regard to that particular issue. You know, there is, in Ephesians chapter 4, just one Lord, and that one is Christ Jesus. The very point that he's trying to get all of us to see is that we've got one standard common authority figure to look to, and that all of us must be submissive to him. That it matters not how, as it were, elevated you may be able to get in the kingdom of the Lord. And I can't imagine really doing much more than becoming an elder in the family of God with all of the great weight and responsibility that rests therein. And yet he wants us to understand that this man likewise must guard against the sin of playing God. And the reason for that is, and that's where the first apostasy came from. And Peter understood that sometimes people's position or their authority or their prominence may rise to their head, and the next thing you know, they've turned loose of their moorings from God. And when we've done that, then we put ourselves up on the plane of God, and we end up with the sin of playing God. And just to show that I won't be as fair as I can be, I'll just tell you another group of folks that I think the New Testament warns us about in this regard, and that's preachers. There's a good many preachers that sometimes come along and they let their position or their opportunities go to their head. Somehow or another, they get the idea in mind that God has put them in charge. That God's put them in charge of the church, period. Or sometimes that God's put them in charge of the local church. And as a result of this, they've developed the concept of evangelistic oversight. The idea that if there are no elders in a church, that means the preacher's in charge. He runs the show. And I think sometimes, brethren, we've enjoyed having it that way. Because, you know, as long as somebody's in charge, we can always point the finger of blame or responsibility or whatever there. We can just kind of burden the responsibility off ourselves and just shift it somewhere else. Again, here's somebody maybe who's willing to accept that. Sometimes, sadly, this kind of a situation exists, even when you do have elders, that there are some that if it doesn't go their way, if they're not really calling the shots and running the whole show, they're not going to stay around. They're not going to be a part of that because they want to be in charge. And yet that's not the responsibility that God has vested on those who preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. And sometimes it can get right down to just any of us who are Christians. We can be guilty of the sin of playing God. Maybe an illustration or two will help you to see that. I almost hesitate to use the first one. Possibly you know the situation better than I do. Some of you, when you hear it, you may know exactly who I'm talking about. But just recently, I received a notification from somebody who was writing in regard to trying to set some matters straight about the church, where they worshiped, where they were a part. And basically what had happened was that there was a disgruntled member of the congregation there who got mad about something or another and left. But before he left, he got a little sheet of paper from a brother who was making one of these little books, you know, that's being put out by some of the brethren to talk about where Christians meet. And if you're informed enough, you know that among some of the institutional brethren, they've got a little book now that they put out that's labeling everybody. They've got one that lists all, quote, churches of Christ, unquote. As long as it's got that name on it, they'll list it. And then inside, what they've done is they've identified the kind of Church of Christ that it is. And they've got a tremendous system of abbreviations. And so churches like Knollwood are just called anti-churches. We're anti the support of orphan homes. We're anti the support of college in the budget. We're anti Herald of Truth. And they've got us listed with all of those kind of anythings in regard to it. Of course, it's put out by institutional people, so they are the sound churches. Whenever you see a sound church, that's the kind of church you're looking at there. And then they've got all of the kinds, you know, from the brethren who believe in the covering to the brethren who don't believe in one more than one container on the Lord's table and no classes and no women teachers and all of the kinds of designations that brethren and their peculiarities have held through the years in some of these things, some matters of judgment and opinion and others matters that are matters of faith without any question or shadow of a doubt. But this fellow was getting a book where he was just putting everything together. And in regard to this particular church, he sent this one brother who was disgruntled the form to fill out. So do you know what he did before he left? He labeled them as a different kind of church than they were. And they're not very happy about the fact that this guy didn't check with anybody to find out. And now the publication has come out, and they're listed as one of these way out kind of groups. And all of a sudden, they're getting calls from people all over the country and letters from other folks that are ready to straighten them all out over there, you know. And as a result of all of this, it's created for them a grand mess. And what I guess somebody decided to do was to sit down and start writing to different brethren around and letting them know, we are not this kind of church. This is what happened, and it's why this is so. And this brother that put out the book's been contacted, and he's going to make the changes in the next publication. But until then, we've got to live with this. But we want to assure you, we're not that kind of a church. Wasn't that a case of a man playing God? Or a few years ago, I could tell you about a church over here in Indiana, where there was a fellow who decided he just had to run everything. In fact, he got to the point where if you were a member of the church and you greeted him, you had to greet him by the term leader, because that was the only way he'd be addressed. He was smart enough to know that he couldn't identify himself as elder because the brethren knew too much for that. And besides, he knew enough that there'd have to be a plurality, and he didn't want to share the spotlight with anybody, so he wasn't about to do that. He later admitted that he really liked the denominational idea of pastor because that's what he saw himself as being. But again, the brethren knew that that was just one of those New Testament designations for elders, and that wouldn't work either. So he decided that he needed to be designated as leader. And that created a stir, as you might well imagine. And so he got into the role of being leader, and he decided who ought to stay and who ought to go and who ought to be kicked out and who'd be welcomed in, and he was doing that. Not only that, but he was the treasurer. And it turned out after a little while that he got into an immoral situation, and the brethren finally got tired enough of everything and decided that in the immoral situation they'd be able to get enough support to do something about it. And one of the first things they tried to do was to get the treasury off of him, get the checkbook off of him. And he wouldn't give it to them. And so they finally had some kind of a meeting where they bypassed him and they went into the bank. And when they got there, they found out they hardly had any money in the bank. And they just couldn't believe it. They'd not been doing anything for years. They thought they had thousands and thousands of dollars there. And it turns out the old boy was embezzling as well. Well, here was a fellow who was creating all kinds of trouble, basically over the fact that he wanted to have a position of authority. He wanted to have the sole leadership kind of position and wanted to be addressed that way. Here was somebody who was playing God. And these kind of things could be sadly multiplied over and over and over again. And all of that it says is that this is not a new problem. Now when you look at these kind of things, you look at ourselves and we say, well, none of those things fit us. These are not the kind of things that any of us are guilty of. So I guess we're really not too anxious in regard to that. And yet I would suggest that there are some things that you and I need to be carefully guarding lest we become guilty of trying to play God. And one of those areas I would suggest is where we'll spend the next few minutes of our time, and that is whenever we try to act like the characteristics or the traits or the attributes that belong unto God belong unto us. And that we are, as it were, in these areas as God is. For example, one of the things that all of us know about God is that he is omnipotent. He is all-powerful. We know that God can do anything that he wants to try to do or that he desires to do. Whatever is according to his will and he desires to do, God is within his ability or his power to go ahead and accomplish that or to do that. And because of this, we sometimes talk about God as the Almighty One. Well, one of the things we know about God is that he is all-powerful to save. Romans chapter 1, verses 16 and 17 establishes that. We have often taught that kind of an idea. And when we understand that God is all-powerful to save, though we may not be stating it, we must surely understand the converse of that as well, and that is that he is also all-powerful to condemn. That is, that those who fail to be as he would have them to be, that he not only does not approve of, but they stand under eternal condemnation. Now my point in all of this is that sometimes man comes along and he begins to act as if he is as all-powerful as God is. And if you want an illustration of that, just simply turn to the 12th chapter of the book of Acts. Beginning in verse 21, we read that upon a certain day, Herod, arrayed in a royal apparel, sat upon his throne and made an oration unto them. And the people gave a shout, saying, "It is the voice of a god and not of a man." And immediately the angel of the Lord smote him, because he gave not God the glory. And he was eaten of worms and gave up the ghost. Notice here, the one thing that you're able to see is that God held Herod accountable for the way that he saw himself and the glory and the honor and the praise that he was receiving here on this occasion. I am sure that God was no doubt displeased with the people who said what they said on this occasion. But without any question of a doubt, you're able to see that God was definitely displeased with Herod because he received glory that did not belong to him. It was glory that belonged only to God. And I would suggest that in that, there is a warning for all of us. It is primarily the warning that if we come along and somebody seeks to glorify us or to give us honor, especially if it be glory or honor that is due unto God, we better be very careful in regard to that. We need to be very careful in how we see ourselves as a result of that, or how maybe because of that we may try to project ourselves where others are concerned. Herod may not have lost his life had he thought a little differently in regard to these matters, if he had not allowed the people's statement, as it were, to turn his head, and he accepted that, and it produced a very serious consequence for him. Well, I don't think many of us would act as blatantly as Herod did here, at least in the proclamation and the acceptance of it. But sometimes that kind of a situation arises. You know, sometimes we may think that we have more power than we actually have. And it kind of boils down to something like this. We come down and we think that really we're powerful enough that the things that bother most people, or the things that bother other people, you know, the things that are temptations, never bother me. It never get to me. Why, it'd never affect me. That doesn't make any difference what it is. Somehow or another, you know, I can dabble with sin. Somehow or another, I can get out here and the things are out of harmony with God. I can look at those things and I can think about it, or I can say about it, or maybe I can act as if I'm powerful enough to resist it. And you know where generally this leads us? It leads us in a downfall, primarily in a lot of moral areas. It's the reason that we have as many difficulties sometimes as we have in the areas of drinking or drugs or fornication, or in the areas of adultery or the problem of abortion. Somehow or another, somebody thought they were powerful enough that it would never affect them, that they would never succumb to a matter like that. They would never yield. It would never get close to them. It would never hurt them. They'd never be hooked by that or enticed or ensnared by such a thing as that. And what we did was we set ourselves up. Rather than staying as far away from the thing as we potentially could, we tried to see how close we could get to it. And you know, sometimes I've listened to some of us talk in regard to these kind of things, and this is the kind of thing I hear. Well, I was taught right. Or I was reared in the right way. I'll be careful. Oh, don't worry about me, preacher. Don't you worry about me getting involved in this or getting any farther involved in this. I'm not going to do anything that's going to cause me to be lost. I value my soul more than that. I'll stop before that. As soon as I see that it is having an adverse effect on me, as soon as I see that it may be jeopardizing me or maybe it's making me, I'll quit. I'll turn away and walk away from it. But don't you worry about me. And you know what happens? What happens eventually is that one day you wake up with a very horrible realization. Generally, it happens about the time that you're a teenager, that you've already done those things you said you'd never have done. And that now you're lost. And now that you've sinned, there's just not any way that as you look at yourself, that you're able to say about yourself that I'm innocent in the sight of God. Not anymore. And do you know what? Generally, that produces in people, at least who have been around the gospel, it begins to produce within them a certain amount of guilt, and it also begins to prompt within them some thinking about the gospel and about their need to obey the gospel. And it's quite often that it's about this time that some of our young people really begin to think seriously as they begin to dawn with the realization that they have done those things that they thought they would never have done, not when they were little. You know, when they were down here maybe 5 or 6 and they went into a class and the teacher was talking to them about some of these things like drugs or alcohol or some of these kind of activities, and they just said, oh, never, not me. And they grew up thinking that, and maybe they got up here as teenagers and they started running with a group of folks who were engaging in those, and they said, not me, I'll not do it. They may get in trouble, but not me. It may hook them, but I'll not even get involved. And the next thing you know, you woke up and you've done it. And it's then that you realize your need to obey the gospel. And quite often what happens gladly is that they do that. They do that very thing. They obey the gospel and become a Christian. And yet once we've done that, we've not remedied the whole problem, because we're still going to battle the problem of sin. As 1 John 1:8 and 10 says. And then sometimes what happens after we've obeyed the gospel is we come along and sin enters into our life and we start kind of rationalizing about it a little bit. And we come along and we say, well, you know, really, I'm not as bad as most people. It's true that I've sinned, and I wouldn't suggest that maybe I hadn't. But still, I got to think that when God looks at me and he looks at those people I work with, or he looks at those people in my neighborhood, or he looks at those people that I associate with out here in school, or maybe he looks at the rest of my family, God would have to say about me that I'm better than all of them are. None of them are trying to even do what's right. I'm not committed anything that's as horrible and atrocious as they have. I don't think like they do. I'm still really a pretty good person. I mean, after all, I'm a Christian. And you see, in that idealistic kind of state, sometimes we come along in our inexperience, I guess we might say, and we say things like, well, I never do the things that others are doing. I mean, you know, I never murder. I'd never steal. I wouldn't shoplift anything. I certainly would never go out here and rob a bank. You won't have to worry about that. Well, I know now the crowd that I'm running with, I admit maybe they might get out here and drink, or they might do drugs, or maybe even they'd get out here and shoplift, and so, but you won't have to worry about me. I'd get not involved in that at all. And the first thing you know, and maybe even before you realize it, you've succumbed to the temptation. You're guilty. And the truthfulness, once again, of what James says in James 1, verses 14 and 15, has been sustained, and that is desire conceives and brings forth sin. And I really think that one of the reasons that our young people have as many problems as they do is because sometimes they think they're more powerful to resist the temptations that are out there and that they sometimes put themselves in the middle of than they actually are. And before any of us who are older sit back and look down our noses at our young people, let me suggest that those of us who are older don't get much better. That what we do is we somehow or another think we're better than our young people. We're not as foolish as they are. We're not as vulnerable as they are. We're not going to make the same mistakes that they are. And we generally don't. You know what we do, don't you? We go out and make other ones. We just go on and do others that are just as bad. And do you know why? Because a lot of times we've convinced ourselves that we're standing. Why do you think Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 12, "Wherefore let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall"? When do you think you're most vulnerable to succumb to temptation? The very time you think you're strong. The very time you think it least likely that you would ever be overcome in a given set of circumstances or a situation is when you're probably at your most dangerous period where life is concerned. I kind of like the way that the Old Testament writer in the book of Proverbs puts it. In the sixth chapter of Proverbs in verse 27, he says, "Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can one go upon hot coals and his feet not be burned?" You know the answer to that as well as I do. You can't go out here and embrace fire without feeling the effects of it. It's going to singe your clothing, or it's going to catch you on fire, and you're going to feel the results of it. Unless you've got some kind of asbestos socks on that nobody can see, you're not going to be able to go out here and walk on a bed of hot coals without singeing the bottoms of your feet. You're going to burn them. I don't care how fast you walk, you're going to have a problem. And what the writer is trying to get us to see is we can't reason like that in some other things as well. We can't come along and say, "Well, you know what, I'm just going to take those drinks." No, you can't. You can't take those drinks without getting burned. You can't take those drugs without getting burned. You can't run with that crowd without eventually getting burned. You can't go out and make out on a date somewhere without eventually getting burned. It's going to happen. And that's exactly what the writer of Proverbs is trying to get us to see. The New Testament writer said it a little differently in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33, when he said that evil companionships corrupt good morals. Or if you want to put in some of the down-to-earth language of modern-day America, since we're moving to Florida. One of the old Florida preachers some time ago said, somebody told me, that if you run with the goats, pretty soon you're going to smell like them. And I think he's right. You may not turn into a goat, but you run with them long enough, and pretty soon you're going to smell like them. And before you know it, you may succumb and be a goat yourself. And it'll happen without ever realizing and without ever intending for it to happen. It just kind of happens. You see, whenever we say, "I never do that, I never engage in that, I never go that way," we may be on our most dangerous ground. You see, the sin of playing God sometimes comes out in thinking that we are powerful enough to resist. I look at the things in your life and I'd say, "Well, I'd never do that. I'd never act like that. I'd never react like that in a situation. I'd never rear my kids like they reared their kids. They're getting every bit of what they deserve." And I just tell you what, when we start thinking like that, we're setting ourselves up. The devil takes that as a challenge. It's the sin of playing God. Or think about it from the standpoint of being omniscient. This just simply means that God is all-knowing, all-wise. He's able to know and understand. He's able to see. It's for this reason, you see, you can't compare the wisdom of God with the wisdom of man. Man has wisdom, but it's not like the wisdom of God. You can't compare the two of them together, can you? That's why Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9 said that as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Or maybe in a descriptive passage that you might not think about in the 139th Psalm, look at the first four verses. O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou hast known my downsitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Did you have a mother like I did? My sister that's married to Lewis Willis and I, because there's 17 months between us, or 19 months between us, kind of like our two boys, we were always concocting something. We always had this, get our heads together, and somehow or another, my mother always knew when we had our heads together and we're trying to come up with something. And inevitably, when we were doing that, before we'd get it out, she'd say, I know what you're thinking. And then she'd proceed to tell us. I never could figure out how she did that. I do remember this. I kept thinking, well, one of these days I'm going to get away from this. Wouldn't you know it, I married a woman just like her. She tells me, I know what you're thinking. You can just go ahead and forget it. And she does. She tells our kids that. But you know, mothers and wives don't know everything. But the 139th Psalm, verse 2 says, God does. He knows every thought that we've got. Jesus in Matthew 6 and verse 8 indicates the same thing in regard to our asking God in the matter of prayer. He knows what we have need of even before we ask him. And maybe we ought to keep that in mind, and that will help us to understand why we don't need any vain repetitions, and sometimes why we don't need to just go on and on and on and on, and why we don't need to be wordy, because God already knows. Maybe more than in prayer, we need to remember that insofar as our lives are concerned. But you know, the sin of playing God comes whenever we decide that we act like God and we know everything. You know, it seems there are some people that are afraid say, I don't know. They see that as a sign of weakness. They see that as a sign that says you're not a very learned person. They don't see that as a sign of strength. And they won't say it. And I tell you what, when you find somebody who won't say, I don't know, I guarantee you, you're going to have trouble eventually in regard to it. A friend of mine was on one of these call-in radio programs, and he said, when we got on, he said, it was my first time. He said, I was scared to death. And he said, my heart was thumping and was having trouble breathing. And he said, I thought I'd come out sounding like some kind of a obscene phone caller when they did give me the opportunity to talk. And he said, I looked at the guy that was cool and calm and collected and on this thing all the time. And I told him, if we get a real hard question, and you know it's going to be a hard one, please just go ahead and deal with it. Act like I'm not even here. And he said, wouldn't you know, the first question we got was a lady who said, I have a question about my family, or it's in my family, about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And he said, it set up one of these situations, you know, where A marries B, and then A divorces B, and A marries C. And C does such and such, so A divorces C, and A marries D. And in the meantime, B marries Z. And in the meantime, this and this. And by the time she got done, there were about 16 or 18 people involved. And when she got done, she said, now, because so many of these people are in my family, I want to know what I ought to tell each and every one of them that they need to do to get right with God. And he said, while all of this is going on, I'm looking at the guy who's the host, and I'm going, not me. Don't ask me. I don't want to answer it. And he said, and wouldn't you know it, as soon as the lady hangs up, the fellow says, we've got brother so-and-so here in the studio with us today. And he said, I sure am glad, because I'm sure he's really going to enlighten us on this first question. And he said, I just freely said, lady, I don't know what to tell you to do. He said, I don't know the answer to the question you've asked. He said, I can tell you what the Bible says. I can tell you what the Bible says about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. But insofar as trying to sort out all of those ins and outs of that situation that took you about 10 minutes to try to fill in, he said, I just wouldn't dare even begin to try to tackle that. But you know, there are some who would say, well, yeah, I can tell you what each and every one of those people ought to do. And I'm afraid in some of those cases, some of us think we know as much as God about all of that. I can tell you what the Bible says in regard to that. And I can hope that you're going to be fair with me, but I'm just taking what you tell me. And I'll be honest with you, you may not necessarily tell me the truth. And I know that. When anybody tells me that, I know that. And you know, there have always been hard questions around that somebody's propounded, hadn't there? I mean, it used to be, before there were baptistries inside, that here was a fellow who heard the truth, and why, he wanted to obey the gospel. And so he came forward at the meeting, and they were going down to the creek to baptize him, and on the way down, a tree limb fell on him and killed him. Now let me ask you, did he go to heaven or hell? Now with the indoor baptistry, it's changed. He's over here and he's changed clothes and he starts up the steps and he has a massive heart attack and dies there before you can get him under the water. Let me ask you, does he go to heaven or hell? And if that's not enough, we've concocted a few more. Here's a fellow who's coming along and he's going into work and he's got his mind on what he's got to do. He's got a presentation to make and he's a little anxious about it and he's all dressed up and he wants to come off looking like a bandbox and sounding like he's got all the answers. He wants to sell this thing. It's a multi-million dollar deal for his company. And as he goes along walking across the parking lot, wouldn't you know it, some nut comes along, hits a water puddle and splashes water on him. And just gets him soaking wet all the way, and he turns and looks at that guy and raises his fist and curses at him. And the next guy comes along, comes around the corner, didn't see him, and just like that, he's dead. He go to heaven or hell? He was a faithful, dedicated Christian. He taught the adult class in an assembly of people like no one. Did he go to heaven or hell? Here's a guy that's out here driving along Interstate 70. He knows the speed limit 65, but he's got his Fuzzbuster on, and he really thinks 65 is a little silly. Now, he's not going to drive 85 or 90, but he is driving 70. And lo and behold, he has a wreck and he's killed in a car wreck out there. Does he go to heaven or hell? And you know what? We got brethren fighting over all that stuff right now. We got brethren going to tell us what way it has to be all the time. You're not surprised we got a mess. And some brethren are at odds with other brethren. They're at other brethren's throats because they don't see it the same way they do. The only question I got about all of that is, who died and left you judge? Or me? I'll just tell you what, I wouldn't take the job. First of all, because the Father assigned it to his Son. That's who's going to do it. And in cases like that, maybe the best thing to remember is two things. The first one's Deuteronomy 29:29. The secret things belong unto the Lord our God, and the revealed things belong unto us and our children forever. I'll tell you what, I'll tell every one of them. I'll tell the fellow that's going to go be baptized, he better be, he's going to be lost. I'll tell the fellow that cursed, he better not curse, because that's not the characteristic language of a Christian. And I'll tell the fellow that's out here driving 70 to 65 miles on, that he better obey the laws of the land, because that's what God expects out of him. But I'll tell you what I won't do, I won't judge him. I got a friend who says, just suppose that you come out here and you go to judgment and God says, enter in. And then the very next fellow that follows you in line is one of these guys in these hypothetical situations we've set up, and he did whatever it was that you were convinced that if he did it, he'd be dead and go to hell. And God told him to enter in too. Let me ask you a question. Would you ask for a transfer? I think that's a pretty good answer, personally. I know this, I won't. Oh, I know there are some things that God has said, they who do such shall not inherit the kingdom of God. And I'll come down on that just as hard as anybody else. But brethren, we got to quit acting like we know as much as God knows. You know where it comes out? Sometimes it comes out in cases where somebody's wrestling with a problem in their life. It's a definite weakness, and once a month, when the invitation of the Lord's extended, they'll come forward, confess the same thing. I did it again. After a short period of time, you know what the rest of us have the audacity to do? Write them off. You know what the rest of us do? It's kind of like a friend of mine who was trying to help a fella come over the problem of strong drink. Once a month, that fella was coming down to the front and confessing that he had succumbed to it. And after he had done that about the sixth or seventh time, the end of a long string, one of the brethren met the preacher in the aisle after the building, and he said, "I don't understand what's the matter with you. Why don't you tell that guy that if he's not going to straighten up, we're going to withdraw from him and get rid of him. He's nothing but a nuisance around here. He's never going to do right. And I'll tell you right now, he's going to go out and do it again." And he said, "You know what went through my mind first thing when he said that to me?" He said, "I'm talking to somebody who knows as much as God." And he says, "You know what? He was right." He said, "Why, the next month, sure enough, there he came again." But he said, "Do you know what? The next month he didn't come. And the next month he didn't come. And the next month he didn't come." And he said, "As far as I know, right now, he's got a handle on that problem." He said, "Now just suppose some of us go ahead and give up, because that's the safest thing to do. Do we know as much as God? If we think we do, we're guilty of the sin of playing God. God's not abdicated the throne to put us in his stead. Not a one of us." Well, my time's up. Certainly this kind of a subject is not up, because there are so many ways that man is guilty of the sin of playing God. I would